In Jerusalem, on the Mount of Olives, there is a Jewish cemetery. It seems like for miles, the white caskets stretch, covering the side of the hill for as far as you can see. And these caskets dominate the view of the city from that angle. When I asked our tour guide, what are those doing there? He told me the story, and he said, many Jewish people want to be buried on the mount so they'll be close to, so that they're close to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where the Old Testament tells us human beings will be resurrected on the day of judgment. So their idea is, once they're dead, to be in the right place when God comes to raise them up. I think Paul builds his letter to the Colossians on a bedrock of unceasing prayer, because praying without ceasing is a way Christians can be in the right place with God while we're alive. Paul doesn't dwell on unceasing prayer in Colossians. He just kind of sets it up as a basis and then goes on from there. But he's very specific about it in other places, like in Thessalonians. But if you look at the reading from Colossians today, prayer is the first thing he says to the Colossians after his greeting. And just a few short verses later, he tells the Colossians that not only have Paul and Timothy been praying for them, but they've been praying unceasingly. What do we have in common with these Colossians for whom Paul and Timothy are praying unceasingly? Well, Colossae is one of the three lush Roman-ruled cities found about 100 miles from Ephesus in the valley of a river called the Lycus River. And the river's waters flow, rich and resplendent, with, if you can believe it, chalk. I've never thought of chalk as flowing in a river. But sure enough, the chalk builds up and it transforms the riverbanks into glacier-like archways and caves and cascades in gleaming, brilliant white. And travelers are drawn to this striking scenery from as far away as 20 miles, and the city of Colossae basks in this, wealthy and very well employed from the dyes from this chalk. They dye cloth, and that's their source of income. And it's brilliant shades of purple and black and scarlet. Well, these new Colossian Christians were just recently introduced to Christ as Savior. And in their daily lives, they're slogging through the river, and they capture chalk, and they dye the wool, and their hands turn a shade of slate gray, I would imagine, from the purple, black, and scarlet. They're very financially well off, maybe not very, but they've got enough money coming in from their work. Their families have plenty to eat, and they have a roof over their heads. They're well-educated, and their lives have a rhythm to them. And this reminds me sort of most of us. Well, let's take a peek at the Colossians this particular night. It's early evening, and the Colossians, these new Christian Colossians, are gathering with neighbors in one neighbor's house, and a man is going to read Paul's letter aloud to them. That's what they did then. They didn't read them individually. It was read aloud. Now, Paul is known only by his reputation, and he's quite a legend to these Colossians. He didn't establish the church at Colossae, but he led the establishment. He basically directed it from afar. And his letter is very well timed, because these Colossians, you know, they're wet behind the ears Christians, and they are not above maybe hearing a word or two from other teachers who are not Christians in town. And they recently have heard something like, hey, you know, you Colossians, following Jesus and living a faithful life, that's not enough to save you. It's not going to get you anywhere. So Paul jumps in with this letter. So they're in the living room of the house in Colossae, and it's really hard to hear the man reading over the gaggle of giggling children. But thankfully, the reader's deep baritone voice carries over the heads of the kids, and they hear. In our prayers for you, we always thank God. Then they're interrupted. One kid whacks another kid, and you hear, George, stop hitting your brother. No, you can't play ball until after the letter. Sit still and listen. Then the Colossian minds wander. What's for dinner? And then a woman most likely thinks, oh, God, the laundry needs to be done when we get home. And they tune back just in time to hear, for this reason, since the day we heard it, we have not ceased praying for you and asking, oh, wait, just a minute, seriously, they think. This guy has not stopped praying for us? Endless prayer? Is that what Christians do? Come on, there's too much else to do. Who has time for ceaseless prayer? I would bet that thought crossed your mind this morning when you heard the lesson. The question, who has time for ceaseless prayer, is as current today as it was for the Colossians. Making time to pray isn't a priority for every Christian, never mind ceaseless prayer, even if it is a way to be right in the right place with God. You know, thinking about unceasing prayer, praying nonstop, is just overwhelming. The Colossians had plenty to distract them from ceaseless prayer, and so do we. The daily grind is chock full. At least it is when we think about prayer as an intellectual exercise. So let's stop thinking about unceasing prayer. It's even hard for me to say. Let's stop thinking about it. I'm not suggesting giving up intentional prayer groups like centering prayer, or no longer attending the Julian gathering here at St. Paul's for contemplative prayer. Please keep blessing your food. Continue the prayers of the people. Your daily private prayer time with Forward Day by Day, or maybe with the daily office, or whatever it is that draws you away from the rapidly rushing world and into God's sacred presence, is critically important. Prayer of any kind is time to be with God. What I am suggesting is to remove unceasing prayer from our intellectual to-do lists. What if we don't think unceasing prayer, but live unceasing prayer as a way of life, as an orientation, as a manner of being in the right place with God, even present with God? What would a life of unceasing prayer be like? Unceasing prayer can be rephrased as praying always. And the words pray always in Greek literally mean come to rest. Well, when I looked at that myself, those words are very opposite. Constantly doing anything is very different from resting. But Henry Nouwen, who is an internationally renowned priest and author, gives us one way to look at it that I found useful. He writes about praying always as a rest in God in the midst of a very intense daily struggle. Ceaseless prayer, then, is a rest in God in the midst of a very intense daily struggle. I suspect each of us would enjoy resting in God in the midst of many of our days. If we're resting in God, we're certainly in the right place with God. So that works out okay. But the challenge arises with Nouwen's next step. He goes on to say, our ability to rest in God depends on our connectedness to our own hearts. Not our Hallmark hearts, where we think of our sentiments being stored, but the Jewish Christian traditional definition of the word heart. Now, the definition is a little bit long, so try to stay with me. You know, we, in Jewish and Christian people, we like sometimes make things a little more complicated. But the definition of the word heart is the source of all physical, emotional, intellectual, volitional, and moral energies. So all those energies wrapped up together. And God dwells in the heart, in the center of, in that heart, in that, with all of those things put together, God dwells in this heart, in the center of every person. So to live unceasing prayer, connectedness to our own hearts, where God dwells, is critical. But connectedness seems to be more challenging the older we get. My sense is that adult hearts can be buried under so many things: work, responsibilities, raising children, caring for aging parents, not to mention just years of living. The older we get, we live more life, and sometimes we allow life to become more mundane. And sometimes life is just really deeply gut-wrenching and soul-wrenching hard. People nearest and dearest to us get really sick. Marriages languish. We hurt one another. But life is also filled with joy. People grow in love. The sun shines and flowers bloom. So reaching our God-centered hearts might mean digging through layers and layers and layers of life soil, and or reawakening to God's ever-constant presence in the seemingly mundane. Either way, connecting with your heart and resting in God as a way of life means you're already in the right place, no matter what life throws at you. Granted, just because I've been talking about unceasing prayer today, you're not going to walk out of St. Paul's and forever be oriented to unceasing prayer. Life doesn't work that way, but unceasing prayer is a way of being that we could strive for. Barbara Brown Taylor says, in her words, she says, the difference between washing windows and resting in God can be a simple decision. Choose the work. Choose the work, and it becomes your spiritual practice. So Barbara agrees that resting in God and praying unceasingly is a choice that each of us can make in our daily lives, and like we often must in our daily lives, choose it over and over, day by day, even minute by minute. Living lives of unceasing prayer consciously cultivates our connectedness. We might rejoice in the setting sun or celebrate the stillness of a sweltering summer forest. We've had a lot of sweltering summer forests lately. We might stand still while a butterfly lights on the bush and just notice the beautiful rhythm almost to its wings. It might be more your style to live a life of unceasing prayer by digging in the garden or going fishing or noticing when your heart leaps, when your tears come, when you clench your back or your shoulders or your jaw. A life of unceasing prayer pays attention to the people around you, wondering about their lives and their loves and what they've lost. Digging and probing and uncovering and peeling back layers of life brings us to unceasing prayer and provides rest in God. Some children know this easier than we do as adults. One children's minister asked a group of children to draw pictures of things that made them think about God. So there were the regular pictures you'd expect: crosses, clouds, hearts, sentimental hearts. Emily, with great color and detail, had drawn an ice cream cone. An ice cream cone. What could an ice cream cone have to do with God? Emily's minister, the children's minister, asked her, "Emily, we were drawing pictures of things that make us think about God. How does the ice cream cone make you think about God?" Emily then unknowingly revealed to the minister just how much easier some children can dig and get in touch with their hearts. She explained, "You know, when you have an ice cream cone, it makes your tummy feel all good inside. Well, when you have Jesus, it makes your whole life feel good inside. God is even better than ice cream." If you think back to your childhood or maybe to another time in your life, you will find times where you felt like your whole life was good inside. I think that deep heart connectedness that feels good is a starting point for that connectedness that Nouwen speaks of. A life oriented to unceasing prayer means even when the sky outside grows dark and hails horrible golf ball-sized chunks of pain and suffering right at you, your heart of hearts still rests in our eternal God. When you have Jesus, it makes your whole life feel good inside. Paul leads by example in his letter to the Colossians. Unceasing prayer is foundational for Christians, but it's not about unstopping, never-ending, constant intellectual prayer. Unceasing prayer is a way of life, a way Christians can be in the right place with God while we're alive, by cultivating an awareness of our heart, our source of all physical, emotional, and intellectual, volitional, and moral energies, we rest in God. Paul brings grace and peace to the Colossians from God and to us from God. And all these years later, his example shines like the chalk cascading from the Lycus River. Let's follow Paul's precedent and try to live lives of unceasing prayer.